Today will be the third part of our lesson on the Decalogue. Can't possibly review everything that we've looked at over the last 2 weeks, but before we begin today, I just want to point out two things that we talked about last week that will be pertinent today. And these are these two theological terms that you see here. The word immanence refers to God's being in the world, his activity in the world, that he is involved in the world, he sustains the world, and he has a plan that is working itself out in the world. If you think about the culture that Israel has just come out of, they've come out of a polytheistic world in Egypt. They're about to be brought into the land of Canaan, where a whole new series of gods will become a temptation to them. And I want to remind you of what we discussed during the discussion of the plagues in Egypt, and that is that the gods of Egypt were not really gods at all. They were the forces of nature. They were the cycles of agriculture. They were elements of life and death that were, in effect, given personalities by the Egyptians, and they ultimately became to be viewed as gods. But they were never gods. This is what's important to understand. They were all trapped inside the universe, inside the world. And in effect, what the Egyptians worshipped were not gods at all, but the creation. It was just the elements of the creation which were personified as gods. That world was dominated by immanence. That's what this word means. These gods were trapped inside the creation. They were part of the creation, and in fact, they were the creation. With the Old Testament, a whole new concept is put forth, and that's the idea of transcendence, that there is a God who goes beyond the world. Inherent in the concept of transcendence is God as creator, that he existed before the world existed. He created the world, and there, though he is still involved in an imminent way in the sustenance and involvement of his plan in the world, he transcends the world and is greater than the world. So I want you to recall that we discussed that last week, and we will be coming back to some of those ideas today. I think what we'll do today, I'm going to try to get through the fourth commandment. Last week we did the prologue and the first commandment. If we don't make it to the fourth commandment today, we will blame Andy, because we're getting about a 20-minute late start to what we normally do here. But for context, if you have your Bibles, turn to Exodus chapter 20. We're going to read through the first 17 verses to give us a context here. This is the section of Exodus known as the Decalogue, or it's the giving of the Ten Commandments. Then God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord, or Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Here God's identity is the justification for his authority and his right to make demands of his creatures. Verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what's in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the waters under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness, or you could translate this covenant love, to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath, to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male or female servant or your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath and he made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. These are the Ten Commandments. We also refer to them as the Decalogue. Last week we began the exegesis of this section. We looked at the prologue and we looked at the first commandment. And we raised the question, why was Israel, and then by extension, why are we responsible to obey the Ten Commandments? Well, there are at least two reasons. The first reason is given in the first five words of our English Bibles. I am Yahweh, your God. The fact that God is the Creator and mankind is the created thing gives God the right to make demands on His creation. The second reason follows because God then describes Himself as the one who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Yahweh is Israel's Savior and Redeemer. He delivered Israel from Egypt, from the house of slavery. And as Martha, where's Martha? There she sits. As Martha so eloquently pointed out last week, as a redeemed people, we belong to God and are rightfully subject to His will. I just want to say a couple of words in review of some things we spoke about last week with regard to the first commandment, which reads, "You shall have no other gods before me." Someone asked me last week if I were going to comment on that phrase, "before me," and I said that I would and then ran out of time and I didn't say anything about it. So let me simply say today that there are two ways this phrase, "before me," could be understood from the text. The phrase in question is a Hebrew phrase, al panai. It literally means above my face. It's a very concrete picture. You shall have no other gods before or above my face. There are two ways we could understand this. This can mean over against. And in this sense, he is saying, you shall have no other gods over against me. This rendering would mean that all false gods, whether real or imagined, stand in opposition to Yahweh, and the commandment then would mean you shall not set up other gods as rival objects of worship. An alternative way to understand al panai would be in addition to me, and in this second possibility, this is really just a restatement of the prohibition against polytheism that we've already seen. I tend to lean toward the first interpretation here, that this commandment means you shall not set up other gods as rival objects of worship. Just a couple of words on some conclusions we drew last week. This first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me, is first in the Decalogue, both numerically and conceptually. Therefore, the prohibition against idolatry should be understood by us as a first principle. As a first principle, it creates the context for the remaining commandments. God alone, because He is the sole God and creator of the universe, is worthy of worship and adoration. He sets the rules for life in the universe He's created. Idolatry, then, becomes an abnormality that results from sin and is the result of fallen man's tendency, which is always to invert or reverse the order God intended and worship the creation itself rather than the Creator. But there's another side to that commandment. There's a prohibition against idolatry. But that prohibition also is an invitation to trust in Yahweh, who's the sole source of Israel's blessing and the sole source of our blessing as believers today. We're actually ready to move on now to the second commandment, which is recorded in verse 4. It's tied very closely to the first commandment. The second commandment reads, "You shall not make yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above, on earth beneath, or in the water under the earth." Simply put, this commandment forbids building an idol for the purpose of substituting that idol for God, or for exalting it above God, or for use in the cultic worship of Israel. I'll speak about that a little bit more. The Hebrew text says you shall not build for yourself something that it calls a pestle. The word pestle is the word for idol. Forgot to write it up here, but it's P-E-S-E-L. It comes from a verb that means to carve or to sculpt wood or stone. So a pestle would be some object that has been carved or in some way fashioned from wood or stone and used, and this is important, as an object of worship. The prohibition extends to images of anything in heaven, anything on earth or anything in what the text says are in the waters beneath the earth. The important thing to know about this is that it's referring to any object of anything in the created world, in the created universe. This is not a prescription against art. Orthodox Jews and Muslims take it that way, and they will refuse to have either two-dimensional or three-dimensional images in their synagogues or places of worship. And in fact, they don't like photographs. They're concerned about breaking this commandment. Certainly, this commandment forbids the making of images of pagan gods for objects of worship, but it also prohibits making an image of Yahweh as an object of worship. Certainly, that may seem a little bit odd. Is it really important for Israel not to make an image of Yahweh? Well, apparently it is, because if you read the 17th chapter of Judges, it's a story about a man whose mother gives pieces of silver to an artisan to make an image of Yahweh, which was then worshipped in the house of a man named Micah. This is not the prophet Micah, but apparently this is an issue that did arise in Israel, and it was the very thing forbidden by this commandment. So Israel is to avoid the pitfalls of idolatry by representing God by any image of anything in the created universe. What's the rationale behind this? Well, the rationale behind this is God's transcendence. All revelation, even the revelation of the Decalogue, gives us some new information about God. The new thing that is being revealed to us here is that Yahweh is greater than the universe he created. He's greater than the plagues that the Jews observed as judgment against the Egyptians. He's greater than the miracle that he performed for Israel at the Red Sea. Both the plagues and the miracle at the Red Sea took place in the world, and they were evidence of God's immanence, of his involvement in the world. But the lesson of this commandment is that the universe and all that's in it fails to comprehend God's transcendent majesty, a majesty that can't be represented by any form of any created thing. The revelation of God's transcendent nature means that as great and as expansive as the universe is, even it cannot contain Israel's God. Therefore, no element of the created universe can be substituted for the transcendent God who created it and who cannot be contained within it or represented by anything that is in the world. Verse 5 then gives us some practical instruction about this commandment, how Israel is to regard it, and the consequences to Israel for disobeying it. The instruction is real simple. Do not bow down to idols or serve them. Israel had served their Egyptian taskmasters in the mud pits in Goshen for generations. They understood the idea of serving. But there's something special in the way this term is used here. And I don't mean to get overly technical, but in Hebrew, consonants are more primary than vowels. In fact, when the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, were written, it was written in consonants only. After a system of writing vowels was developed, on rare occasions, the vowels of the word being written would not be written, and substituted for them would be vowels from some other word. Here, where it says, "You shall not serve them," the consonants of the word serve appear, but the vowels are from the noun shame. It's as though service to idols doesn't even rise to the level of the service Israel paid in the mud pits of Goshen. For an Israelite, idolatry is a step down from his former status as a slave. Then the consequences for disobedience are given in verses 5 and 6. "For I'm a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of fathers upon children unto the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing covenant love to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." One of the difficulties of teaching through a book like this is you don't get to skip verses like this. If you're just going through looking for topics to talk about and you find a verse in the Bible that says that God visits the iniquity of the fathers on the children under the third and fourth generations, you might want to just skip that because that's a hard one. But we don't get to do that. So let's do our best with this. The first thing I want you to notice is that God proclaims himself to be a jealous God. In Hebrew, the word for jealous can mean one of two things. It can be zeal for one's own property, one's own possessions, or it can be zeal for the property of another. This latter type of jealousy is bad. It's condemned in the 10th commandment as covetousness. But the former jealousy, zeal for one's own possessions, is appropriate, and it's this kind of zeal that is in view here when God says, I'm a jealous God. It's appropriate because Israel belongs to God, and he has every right to claim her as his own and to expect loyalty in return. It's, in effect, a marriage. Look sometime at the book of Hosea. You'll see how that metaphor there is developed throughout that whole book. So after God emphasizes his claim on the people, he gives then the consequences of disobedience. He will visit the iniquity of a father upon his descendants unto the third and fourth generations. This would be unto children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. So let me ask you a question. This is not a rhetorical question. There will be some of those in a minute. But what is special about the second, third, and fourth generations? Why not the sixth, seventh, and eighth? Or 10th, 11th, and 12th? The question is, what is special about the second, third, and fourth generations? The answer is, those are descendants that a man might expect to see and know in his own lifetime. His children, his grandchildren, and his great-grandchildren. I think there's a hint in this as to how we are supposed to interpret this passage. Here's the rhetorical question. So what does this mean? Does God punish children for the crimes of their parents? You remember last week when I said that we came to a difficult passage and I said that Bruce Waltke made a distinction between a religious command and a theological statement? So the question here would be, can we find a statement of theology any place in the Bible that would help us understand what this verse means? And in fact, I believe we can. And it's found in the 18th chapter of the book of Ezekiel. Let me read to you the 20th verse from Ezekiel 18. The person who sins will die. The son will not bear the punishment for the father's iniquity, nor will the father bear the punishment for the son's iniquity. The righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself. Now, this is the theological statement. This is what you can take to the bank. So that's our starting point. In fact, the theme of the entire 18th chapter of Ezekiel reinforces the conclusion that every man stands singularly accountable to God for his own actions. That being the case, how do we square up Exodus 20, verse 5, where it says God visits the iniquity of a man on his descendants, with Ezekiel 18:20, which says he doesn't? Well, I think the answer lies in what you might call the you reap what you sow principle. Here's what I mean. One thing we know about God's judgment, it's not always immediate. But in this, the father is taught a painful lesson when he sees his own wickedness work itself out in the lives of his sons and his grandsons and his great-grandsons. Ask any man who's seen his own sins work themselves out in his children, and he will admit to despair and a hard time dealing with that. Not only does the spiritual failure of the sons punish the father, but the sons are punished for continuing the sins of their father in their own generations. The question that's raised in Ezekiel 18 is, why are we, the sons and grandsons and great-grandsons, in exile for the sins of our fathers? Ezekiel's answer is, you're not in exile because of the sins of your fathers. You're in exile for continuing those sins in your own generation. But the converse is also true. If you look at verse 6, God says, but in contrast to this, I show covenant love or loving kindness, covenant love to thousands of generations to those who love me. That's the other side of the coin. God's generosity and his goodness grow out of his infinite love for Israel and his love for all the peoples of the world who have a relationship with him through Jesus Christ. Those who carry forward the faith of Father Abraham will receive God's blessings, and they'll receive them to not two, three, or four generations, but to thousands of generations. That's what I think this means. The third commandment is in verse 7. You shall not take the name of Yahweh your God in vain, for Yahweh will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. The correct interpretation of this verse rests on the understanding of two terms, the term name and the term vain. Let's begin by thinking about the name. When we speak about God's name in the context of the covenant, we're talking about the name Yahweh. Yahweh is four Hebrew consonants, and we're pretty sure that those four consonants were pronounced Yahweh. This is the name that in Exodus 3 and 4, God further explains to Moses. I'm not going to try to reteach our lesson on Exodus 3 and 4, but let me just review a couple of highlights. If you were to translate the word Yahweh into English, it means He is. It's also possible to translate Yahweh as He causes to be, which might imply creatorship. When God revealed his name to Moses, if I may paraphrase for a moment, he said, I am the one who is, the one who causes to be, all to which the term is can be applied. Yahweh's the source of his own existence, and he's the source of yours and mine as well. He is life itself, and apart from him, there's no life. Yahweh is also the covenant name of God. It's the name under which he deals with his people, particularly with Israel under the covenant. If you want to think of it this way, it is his salvation name. It's the name that links believing Jews of every generation to Abraham and the patriarchs and the covenant that God made with them. Keep in mind also that to the Semitic mind, the name and the person are synonyms. There's no difference. There's no difference in the name and the essence of the person. So to misuse the name of God is to deny the essence of who God is. But what does it mean to use the divine name in vain? Well, the Hebrew word that's translated vain is the word shav. It means emptiness, vanity, and falsehood. It's used 52 times in the Old Testament, but probably the most famous occurrence is the one right here in this commandment. If you study the word shav elsewhere in the Old Testament, sometimes it's used to refer to false testimony or false witness against a neighbor. It can refer to false worship, specifically worship that is correct in form, but lacking in spiritual substance. Shav can refer to the making of an insincere oath. It can mean to swear falsely. Prophets who spoke falsely in the name of God violated this commandment. If we want to try to understand it in a more contemporary setting, churches that proclaim false theology violate the third commandment. Christians who claim to have heard God speak but who have not heard him break this commandment. When God's name is invoked in the context of the trivial and the mundane, commandment may very well be broken. What I would call bumper sticker theology, and even a lot of cliches, may in fact break this commandment. When someone says something that must be followed by the disclaimer, hopefully God has a sense of humor. He may be dangerously close to breaking this commandment. When preachers invoke God's name for the purpose of self-enrichment, they violate the third commandment. And certainly to invoke God's holy name in the context or act of swearing is to disrespect God himself and is a violation of this commandment. My point isn't to list every conceivable way to break this commandment. The rabbis have written much on the subject. You're welcome to read that. My point is to point out that Israel and we are to respect the sanctity of God's name. There's a good example of what this means over in Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 58 through 60. This is an appropriate usage of God's name. Moses says, if you're not careful to observe all the words of this law which are written in the book, to fear this honored and awesome name, the Lord or Yahweh your God, then the Lord will bring extraordinary plagues on you and your descendants, even severe and lasting plagues, and miserable and chronic sickness. He'll bring back to you all the diseases or plagues of Egypt, of which you were afraid, and they shall cling to you. Now, this is written to Israel, but it provides an example of how Israel and we should respect the name of God. We're told to hold God's name in reverence and to respect it, for it represents God Himself. It's not for use in purposeless conversations or jokes, and God will not hold guiltless those who do such things. For Israel, the misuse of the divine name risked bringing severe judgment on the nation. In fact, the very plagues that they had seen God bring on Egypt prior to the Exodus. Verse 4 contains the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. This is the commandment. What follows in verses 9 through 11 explains why the commandment was given. Have you ever wondered why one of the Ten Commandments has to do with the setting aside of a special day in Israel's life, the Sabbath? God could have given the 12 commandments and included the Passover and the Day of Atonement. Why just 10? Why the Sabbath? Well, it's because this section of the law does not pertain to special days, feasts, or celebrations. The Sabbath is included in the Ten Commandments because of the link that Moses makes back to the creation story of Genesis. And I'm going to talk about this here in just for a moment, but I want to start with looking at how this is written here in the text. The fourth commandment begins with the word remember. For just a moment this morning, I want to just talk to the men, okay? Not the women. But it's funny, all the women perk up when they hear that. How many men are married in here? All right, that's pretty good. What holidays coming up on February 14th? All right, Valentine's Day. How about anniversaries? Does any man here have an anniversary? One person. One last question. Does your particular wife celebrate birthdays? Yes? Okay. So here's the question. How would it work out at your house if one or more of these days came and you just remembered as a cognitive process that it was Valentine's Day or your wife's birthday or your anniversary and just let it go at that? How would that work out for you? I don't have time to tell this, but when we lived in Michigan, we were sitting out on the front porch one day and the mail came and I started looking through the mail and all the mail was to Linda. It was really weird. I gave her all the mail and she opened up this envelope and money fell out. And I thought, well, that's really odd. And she opened the next one and the $5 bill was in it. And she opens the next one and I said, what's the deal? First of all, why did we get all this? You get all this mail and money's falling out of the envelope. She said, well, maybe because it's my birthday. Do you remember that? Do you remember the time I told you that, well, I didn't get you a Valentine because I thought it was just for little kids in grade school? Do you remember that? Aren't you expected on these days to do more than remember? If so, if you understand the difference in firing off a few neurons up here to cause your brain to know that it's your anniversary versus buying your wife a card or taking her to dinner, if you can process that difference, then you understand the meaning of the Hebrew word zakar. See, this class is better than Rosetta Stone. You're going to all be Hebrew scholars before it's over. Zakar means to remember. In Hebrew, to remember denotes an active relationship with the object of the memory. And that relationship is more than a cognitive process. In Genesis 8, verse 1, we read, and God remembered Noah and all the animals that were with him in the ark. and he caused the wind to pass over the earth so that the water subsided. If you notice in that example from Genesis 8, the verb remembered is followed by the verb caused. Biblical remembering always results in some kind of action. This may seem odd to say that remembering the Sabbath involves some kind of action when we tend to think of the Sabbath as a day of rest. But Zakar, to remember, asks Israel to be involved actively in the observance of the Sabbath. The Sabbath observance is supposed to be more than lying on the couch on Sunday afternoon and watching a football game. To understand how this all fits together, we need to think about the word holy. Probably the best translation of this commandment is this: remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. Not to, but by. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. The way you remember the Sabbath, the way you are involved actively in remembering the Sabbath day, is by making it holy. The essence of holiness is otherness. That means that the Sabbath should not be like any other day. In this case, holiness is a setting aside of this one day as a special day for remembering who God is and contemplating the things God has done for Israel. The Sabbath was to be spent with man's focus on God and the covenant. The cessation of work demonstrates that you actively acknowledge the priority of God's agenda over your own. When Jesus healed on the Sabbath, he was doing God's agenda and he was ignoring the agenda established by the Pharisees. The Sabbath was observed as a state of rest, but not necessarily rest as we tend to think of the term. So we come to this commandment, and it's followed by a rather long explanatory section that links the Sabbath day observance back to the creation account of Genesis. Why is that? Well, to understand this, we need to think about the word Shabbat, from which the word Sabbath comes, and there are some related terms that are key to us. This verb Shabbat, from where we get the word Sabbath, means to cease. Examples of its usage in the sense of to cease can be seen in Joshua 5:12 and in Job 32, verse 1. Semantically, Shabbat means to cease from the activity in which one is engaged. And there is in this a subtle suggestion that this cessation is due to that work having been completed. This is how it's used in Genesis chapter 2. Listen. By the seventh day, God had completed his work which he had done, and he rested, and the word is Shabbat, he rested on the seventh day from all his work. So, Shabbat is not disengagement as we tend to think about it in our day. It's a cessation of work that results in a state of rest when all the obstacles are removed and all the responsibilities have been met. The most significant thing to remember about this cessation, this ceasing of work from Shabbat, is that it denotes the completion of one's tasks that enables you to enter into a new and a different state of rest. Now, that new state of rest, there are two words here that I wrote. Shabbat is what we've been talking about, and there's the word nuach. Nuach is also translated rest. There's something going on here that would not be evident from reading any of the English translations. This is one of those occasions where access to the Hebrew text is very important to understanding the concept of divine rest. I've said many times that knowing Hebrew really sometimes makes things more complicated rather than less complicated. This is one time when it's important to get back to the original language here. Exodus 20, verse 11. That's the verse that says, "For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them, and rested." That's the key term. "Rested on the seventh day." That's a quote, more or less, from Genesis 2, verses 2 and 3. But here's what you don't see in the English translations. The word translated rest in Genesis 2 is Shabbat. But when it's quoted in Exodus 20, verse 11, Moses changed the word to nuach. Your English Bibles both say rest. The Genesis passage uses Shabbat. The Exodus passage uses nuach. Here's the point. There is a soteriological, a salvation aspect to the change in vocabulary. The ceasing, that is the Shabbat of Genesis 2, allows Israel to enter into God's rest, the nuach of Exodus 20, verse 11, as a new creation. It's as a new condition for Israel. It's a state of salvation. In the book of Joshua, we read, "Remember what Moses commanded you. Yahweh gives you rest," that term is nuach, "and has given you this land." Every time Israel ceased from her labor, every time she observed Shabbat, ceased from her labor, it was a celebration of the salvation blessing God had bestowed on the nation in the promised land. For New Testament believers, our rest is not found in the position in the promised land, but in our position in Christ. The commandment to observe the Sabbath as Israel observed the Sabbath is not repeated in the New Testament. So our relationship to this commandment is different than Israel's relationship. In fact, we know that Christ fulfilled the Sabbath, for he fulfilled the entire Mosaic law. And Paul sums this up for us quite succinctly when he writes, "No one is to act as your judge regarding food or drink with respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day, things which are a mere shadow of what's to come, but the substance belongs to Christ." So, what does the Sabbath mean for us today? First, we're not under the Mosaic law, so there's no requirement to keep the Sabbath in the same way that Israel kept the Sabbath. Christ himself is our Sabbath because it is in him that we experience the salvation rest promised to Israel in the land of Canaan. But it's obvious from the New Testament that the church saw a need for a regular day of worship and fellowship and communion, and they were admonished, in fact, for perhaps forsaking that at times. So we know this was important to the New Testament church. The church didn't choose to observe this special day on the seventh day of the week, but rather on the first day to commemorate the resurrection of Christ, which marks the completion of God's salvation work. The specific day that we do this is less important than the way God's salvation is commemorated. So I thought what we would do today is close by asking this question, and I'm asking this as an actual question, it's not rhetorical. How do you think we should reflect the spirit of the Sabbath as New Testament Christians without falling into the trap of legalism? What does the Sabbath mean to us today, and how can we observe it? What is important about it for us? We're not under the law. God has not said to us, you must keep the Sabbath, as he did to Israel. And yet the early church commemorated God's salvation and deliverance through meeting together as a congregation on a particular day. What I really want you to take away from this is the significance in these two words. That Shabbat is the cessation from work. It's setting aside your agenda, which allows you, based on the finished work of Christ, to fellowship with him in a state of rest, which is really another way of saying grace, God's grace. We are in the salvation state, the state of grace, because all the work has been finished. The Sabbath was originally, and is still, I think, for God. It was God who rested. Israel emulates that rest when she observes the Sabbath. And she rests in not her own agenda, but in that salvation state, that state of nuach, which results from what God has done. In a sense, this whole series on Decalogue has been about obedience. There's a practical side to this. We shouldn't view Sundays or the Sabbath or however you want to phrase this as being under law. But there's a practical aspect to slowing down your life setting aside a day when your focus is not on your job or making money or anything like that. Not worrying about where you've got to travel to next week, but setting aside a day to contemplate who God is and what He's done for you. And I think that the essence of the way we are to appropriate this commandment in our own lives today is not from a legalistic point of view, but from just that practical point of view, that's a necessary part of our own spiritual lives.